This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. The 2024 spring election saw the most school referendums on the ballot since at least 2000, but voters approved just 62 of the 103 school district referendums across the February and April ballots. That's the lowest passage rate for school referendums during a midterm or presidential election year since 2010, according to a new analysis from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Two-thirds of the referendums proposed this spring asked voters to raise property taxes to support ongoing school operations, contrary to a capital referendum to add, say, a new structure or feature for a school. That's as districts face a perfect storm of pressures, including higher costs and expiration of federal aid released during the pandemic. Many more school referendum questions are likely to be on the ballot come this November.
A nearly 50-hour lawn overflow caused more than 350 million gallons of wastewater to be released into local Milwaukee waterways. The overflow began after heavy rainfall on April 2nd and filled the city's main deep storm sewer tunnel to 76% capacity. The overflow did not end until the late evening of April 4th. The Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that the water sources affected include the Menominee River, Milwaukee River, and Lake Michigan. The sewage district is typically able to clean around 98% of wastewater that goes through their pipes, but climate change has brought on more intense storms at faster rates. To address this problem, the district is trying to restore habitat and install green infrastructure, which will naturally absorb and store rain and snow to protect against things like flooding. These changes also seek to improve the quality of the air, soil, and water in the area.
As UW-Madison celebrates Wisconsin Idea Week, one Wisconsin idea is getting retired. Specifically, the Ideas Network, which carries locally produced talk programs alongside other syndicated shows on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's one of many programming changes afoot at Wisconsin Public Radio, announced today by WPR Director Sarah Ashworth. Starting next month, WPR's two networks will rebrand to simply WPR News and WPR Music. Locally produced listener call-in programs The Morning Show and Central Time will be canceled. So will programs produced by regional bureaus like Route 51 and Newsmakers. WPR will also stop carrying some syndicated programs like 1A+, As It Happens, Q, and Milk Street Radio. WPR is launching a new morning program called Wisconsin Today. Meanwhile, The Larry Miller Show will expand to a daily two-hour slot. This programming shuffle won't come with any staff layoffs, though some jobs are expected to change. The programming changes at WPR take effect in just under 6 weeks on Monday, May 20th.
A brew pub near Camp Randall Stadium will get citations from Madison police after a raid late last week discovered that most of their patrons were underage. Lucky's 1313 Brew Pub on Regent Street was subject to a liquor law and bar check last Friday evening, reports WKOW-TV. And law enforcement uncovered that of the 190 people inside the bar, 160 were underage, according to a MPD spokesperson.
A new gaming lounge is coming to the lower end of State Street this summer. It's slated to open at 668 State Street, nestled between a bookstore and a chain burrito restaurant. Co-owners Jin Lee and Sonia Tan tell the Wisconsin State Journal that they're seeking to create a place for gamers to come together in Madison. Named The Guild, the lounge will include dozens of gaming computers along with console stations, including PlayStations, Xboxes, and Nintendo Switches. Rounding out the lounge are a private virtual reality room, bar and snack menu, and older consoles like Atari devices available on request. And those were tonight's headlines. Now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Today, Governor Tony Evers renewed his call for Republican state lawmakers to release $125 million in PFAS remediation funding. WORT News producer Faye Parks has this update.
Today, Governor Evers set a special meeting of the state's powerful budget writing committee to take action on funding PFAS remediation. $125 million was set aside in last year's state budget to help communities combat contamination. But that funding has sat idle, as Evers and state Republicans spar over the mechanics of releasing that funding. And after more than 9 months of back and forth with state Republicans, that funding still hasn't been touched. State Republicans argue that the Budget Writing Committee should have the final say over how to spend it. But Governor Evers argues that the Department of Natural Resources should be able to allocate the funds immediately. The state legislature passed a bill late last year that would have provided guidelines for the DNR, and Republican leadership on the state's budget writing committee said Evers' signature was vital to proving his concern over PFAS contamination. But according to the governor, the bill contains poison pill provisions that would protect polluters and not the environment. He proposed a compromise in February, asking the budget writing committee to release the $125 million to the DNR. In turn, the DNR would follow most of the guidelines set in the Republican-authored bill, minus the toxic provisions. The budget committee did not respond to that request. So Governor Evers vetoed the Republican-authored bill today and called a special meeting of the budget committee for next Tuesday. Also on the agenda for next Tuesday's meeting, a request for the committee to release $15 million in crisis response funding that has also been sitting idle. That's unlikely to happen. While the governor has the power to call the legislature into special session to address a specific pressing issue, state Republicans have held that he can't call a special meeting of the Joint Finance Committee without their approval. In a statement this afternoon, the Republican co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee characterized Evers' move as phony and reiterated that they can't be called into session by the governor. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
As the weather warms up, some Wisconsin farmers will be moving their livestock around a lot more, a practice called managed grazing. This practice can improve soil health, and it now comes with the possibility of new federal funding. Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection has a story.
The milk you drink or the beef you eat may have come from a farm that rotates its livestock in a certain way to establish a healthier landscape. Wisconsin farmers who practice managed grazing have another chance for new federal funding. The USDA has announced that $22 million is available for regional networks of farmers who offer peer-to-peer technical assistance on this practice. The approach involves raising and feeding livestock in a pasture and moving them regularly, allowing that section of land to recover. When federal funding was restored last year, Michael Fields Agricultural Institute's Margaret Crome says the demand was overwhelming.
It really wasn't a very long application period, and we still had a lot of applicants that couldn't get funded because there was just not enough money. And we anticipate that will happen again. We really want to make sure Wisconsin farmers have their organizations apply.
These waves of assistance come after a 15-year absence of federal funding for the Grazing Lands Conservation Initiative. Crome says they're hoping to regain momentum this movement saw in previous decades. The application deadline is May 26th. Some of the benefits linked with managed grazing include improved soil health and carbon sequestration. In northwestern Wisconsin, dairy farmer Kevin Mahalko has been doing managed grazing on his land for nearly 30 decades. He says it has allowed his operation to survive difficult stretches, including drought, and it keeps his expenses lower.
The cow is doing more of the work and using fencing instead of as much equipment. Cuts down on a lot of repairs and maintenance and diesel fuel.
Crome says expanding these education networks can especially help beginning farmers as technology improves with things like electric fences for moving livestock. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Over the last month, Madison residents have been debating the pros and cons of the city's draft West Area Plan. But there's a second area plan that's also in development. That's the draft plan for Madison's northeast side. And that plan is getting far less public engagement. Allison Garfield, a local government reporter with the Cap Times, published an article yesterday outlining the draft northeast area plan. She gave WORT News producer Faye Parks the rundown earlier today.
Thank you for joining me, Allie.
Oh, happy to be here.
So we've all heard a lot about the draft West Area Plan, but what is the Northeast Plan and what parts of the city does it cover?
So the Northeast Area Plan is similar and it's in the same exact phase as the West Area Plan, which is still draft phase, but there are recommendations for that plan. It's kind of been moving along the same schedule as the West Area Plan, both of which, you know, kind of lay the groundwork for future development and some improvements for those neighborhoods over the next decade. And the Northeast Area Plan covers about 6,000 acres from southeast-ish, southeast of the airport, all the way to the East Town Mall. It's basically, when you think of like the northeast side, it's everything east of the airport on that north side of the city. And even though it's in the same exact place as the West Area Plan, I think a lot of folks, at least I didn't know about it. And I know the city has been struggling a bit more of getting the word out about this plan versus the West Area Plan, which has had a lot of engagement, a lot of feedback. And it's just very interesting to see the contrast on the other side of the city there.
And so what are some of the main recommendations laid out in the draft Northeast plan?
So it's kind of a similar groundwork, similar priorities as the West plan, which is to create more commercial spaces, more densities, kind of the language we're hearing, along transit routes to accommodate more housing. And so it's similar on the Northeast side, the three broad land use recommendations, changing some of those recommendations to create more mixed-use buildings north of East Washington Avenue toward the Easttown Mall. So those mixed-use spaces usually are like commercial and retail spaces on the bottom with housing on top of it, is kind of what that has typically looked like in the city. And the plan also recommends more low to medium residential housing, which the city calls it missing middle housing. So that's the kind of space in between a house and a high-rise apartment. So duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, that kind of space, which at least the city thinks is key for more affordable housing options. And then just kind of more commercial and employment space generally north of the airport. And those are the big, I guess, recommendations in the plan.
So why do you think it's getting less engagement? How does that part of town differ from the west side?
A very different demographic of people over on the northeast side than the west side. And that's what I've heard from city officials. That's what I've heard from folks living over there. You don't get as many single family homes. You know, you see a lot more renters. It's a bit more diverse, that part of the city. I mean, it's the second most diverse part of the city outside of South Madison. You know, houses cost less over there. I think for that reason, at least the city planners I talked to kind of chalked it up to, like, you know, because of those different demographics, there are different concerns about the future, almost surprisingly directly opposing concerns or priorities for what they would like to see. On the west side, we heard a lot of concern from homeowners over there about, you know, some historic neighborhoods that have a lot of single family homes. What will they look like if there are a lot of new apartment buildings going up or multi-use spaces, right? And on the east, on the northeast side, I should say, at least what I've heard a bit from the folks I've talked to in that area, is rather than concern about, you know, destroying the character of the neighborhood, it's how do we create more character? How do we make this an appealing place for people to put down roots?
You also spoke with Kate Pinkston, who lives within the Northeast Plan's boundaries and is president of our neighborhood association. So I understand she does have concerns about that plan. Is it just about the amount of public engagement, or there are other concerns that she discussed?
I can really only speak to what she told me and hopefully characterize it as well as she, I guess, voiced it to me in those concerns. But what I understood of her concerns is a concern about balance and balancing what gets put in each of these neighborhoods, which is an interesting conversation as we're seeing, you know, these two area plans play out, and there are going to be 10 more after this. So this is going to be an ongoing conversation. The city is doing them two at a time, and we'll be continuing to do that. And so I think when you put these two plans, you know, next to each other and compare the feedback and what is going into these plans, for Pinkston, she was worried about balancing need and creating, you know, some kind of attraction to the northeast side. And she expressed, you know, the concern about the decline of the Easttown Mall and seeing, you know, the permanent men's homeless shelter go up on the northeast side as well. And so with things that may be considered less desirable in a residential neighborhood, but necessary for the city, you know, for Pinkston, it was, okay, if we're seeing those things, can we have some things that are drawing people here as well? And there was also, you know, concern about being listened to and having those concerns actually heard by the city. But it seemed to me like that was the main concern as this plan moves through the process.
So I understand that this plan does not have any proactive rezoning. Is that accurate?
That is true. Or I guess at this point in the plan, there is no proactive rezoning included in the recommendations. That is something city planners are still, I think, looking at and thinking about, and what Angela Puerta, one of the planners on this project, told me was that because of all the pushback on the West Area plan from residents about proactive rezoning specifically, they kind of took a step back and said, hey, do we need this? And if we do, what do we want it to look like? How do we make sure that we are really addressing the concerns that we've already seen come about and doing this in an intentional way? And so there are no current plans for proactive rezoning in the Northeast plan. These are both still in draft format, and they are both accepting public feedback, and the city is requesting that. You know, I think we're also seeing a lot of conversation about how that's done. It seems like the best way to do that is online from the city. We've seen some concern from residents about these in-person meetings and not feeling like there is that space and time to share those thoughts and concerns in person. So the best way to do that right now is to share those thoughts and concerns online, it seems like.
I heard that the city has pushed back the public feedback deadline for both plans. Do you know what that timeline looks like now, when they might send the plans to the Common Council for approval?
That's the million-dollar question right now. There is no set timeline anymore for this. These plans were both originally supposed to move through the approval process in April and May, you know, go to the plan commission as well as other committees before getting final approval by the city council. That's kind of all on hold right now as the city kind of collects feedback and figures out what changes they're going to implement, if any. And so they're still very much in that feedback collecting process. So it's hard to say when any of this is going to be moving through that approval process. Angela Puerta with the city did say she is hoping for that to happen in the late summer. So that's, you know, a few months behind what they originally had planned. And we'll just kind of have to wait and see if that is what happens and what changes actually do get implemented into the West Area Plan and this Northeast Plan as well, if any of the resident feedback actually makes its way into those. So I'll be following that. You can follow the cap times for that. I'm sure you guys will be continuing to watch this as well. So it'll be something to keep an eye out on.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Allie.
Thank you. Yeah, it was lovely to chat.
That was Allison Garfield, a local government reporter with the Cap Times. In a recent article, she explored Madison's draft Northeast Area Plan, which is getting far less engagement than the controversial draft West Area Plan. Garfield says that according to city planners, the lopsided public engagement is due to a difference in the area's demographics and the residents' priorities.
On this episode of Yale's Climate Connections, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz explains how expectant parents can prepare for extreme weather. If extreme weather strikes during labor or soon after you give birth, experts say you'll need some backup options.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Expectant parents may spend months preparing to give birth, developing a relationship with a doctor or midwife, arranging a babysitter for other children when it's time, and mapping the best route to the hospital. But during an extreme weather disaster, things may not go as planned.
So I would suggest for people to start now doing their due diligence of knowing what-if situations.
Tanya Smith-Johnson works with the Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies Coalition of Hawaii, a maternal care nonprofit, and she's a certified professional midwife. She suggests that pregnant people identify friends and family who can serve as backup support, as well as alternate healthcare providers.
Who are the folks where they can offer services or can lead you in the right way if you can't get access to the hospital or to the doctor that you're seeing?
To make sure you can connect with these people, even when the power is out, she suggests getting a solar phone charger or one that plugs into your car. She says it's important to build a support system of people who can help if you end up going into labor during an extreme weather event.
because we can't do this alone. And especially when things devastating and catastrophic happen, we have to lean on each other.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us.
In last Tuesday's presidential primary, more than 30% of campus area voters chose the uninstructed delegation on their ballots. Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the Daily Cardinal Student Newspaper, is back from spring break. Today, host Oliver Gerhars talks with the Daily Cardinal's photo editor Mary Bosch to discuss her article on last week's spring primary.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your weekly dose of UW-Madison campus news from the Daily Cardinal Student Newspaper. I'm your host, Oliver Gerhars. In Tuesday's Democratic primary, more than 30% of campus area voters supported the uninstructed delegation option, signaling a significant lapse in connection between the Biden administration and the youth. Today we're joined by the Daily Cardinal's photo editor, Mary Bosch, to discuss her article on the voting trend and its broader implications for this year's election. Mary, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So why was it that uninstructed delegation had so much popular support on April 2nd?
So the widespread movement of the uninstructed delegation or an uncommitted vote in other states is basically to show that people are unsupportive of President Biden's policy in Israel-Palestine, specifically providing aid and military aid to Israel, and therefore people are voting because they believe he's complicit in the war, and the goal of it is to have him completely change his policy.
So what does uninstructed delegation in simple terms mean?
Uninstructed delegation means you're voting for a specific party because they have uninstructed Republican or Democrat, but you're specifically not voting for a candidate. It's like a deliberate way to say, I'm not voting for this specific candidate, although, you know, I might be a part of this party.
In your article, you mentioned that certain campus groups are campaigning for the vote. And so what were those groups?
So the main group that I talked with was a student from Students for Justice in Palestine, and they had been doing flyers on campus. They'd been doing phone banks, which is more of a statewide thing, also holding rallies just like within their club. And actually, along with SJP, the other groups that were campaigning for this was the Wisconsin Young Democratic Socialists of America. The Muslim Students Association was also a part of it. And they all were kind of in a group campaign with this larger protest group called Listen to Wisconsin.
So how big is Listen to Wisconsin?
They were campaigning throughout the state of Wisconsin, but they particularly focused their efforts in Madison and Milwaukee. They were searching for volunteers in those places, you know, to just be out and about on the day of polling. So that's their main focus, I'd say.
So Listen to Wisconsin is a statewide organization, right? Are there any similar movements in other states?
The most well-known probably would be in Michigan. In Michigan, they reached 13% statewide, and in two districts, because you need to surpass 15% of the votes in order for it to count enough to send a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. And in two districts, they met the 15% threshold, so two uninstructed delegates will be chosen.
In Michigan?
Yeah, none of the Wisconsin districts reached the 15% threshold to make that happen. Some got really close.
What kind of work does Listen to Wisconsin do outside of the context of college campuses?
Listen to Wisconsin is not in any way tied, I think, directly to college campuses. I think they were just doing some campaign events. So I think they just saw the opportunity to campaign on campuses where there's a lot of young people who are in support of this movement, especially working with groups that already have this as part of their mission statement. They campaign all over the state in many different ways.
So the support was strongest right in the campus area. What was the percentage on that?
So for context, the state of Wisconsin, the percent was like 9.5 about uninstructed vote for the entire state. Then if you look in like the districts like Madison area and Milwaukee area, it's like closer to like 14%. Now, if you're looking actually on campus, our college news editor, Noe Goldhaber, actually did her own data analysis, and we worked on it together for this article because all large polling places don't really release percentages like in more specific areas. So in a district, there's a bunch of different wards. What we did is we chose about 20 wards that are on campus, on UW-Madison campus, and in areas that are highly populated by students. We looked at the percentages for those places specifically, and it's about 32% on UW-Madison campus. In some wards, it was even high as like 48%. The wards close to UW-Madison campus, you know, well pushed ahead like the 15%, but the rest of the district like didn't quite pull through.
So what kind of wider implications does this have for the presidential election?
What it's showing is that people don't like Biden. It's showing that people have issues with his current policy and they're trying to express that to him. And actually, someone from WISDEMS said in an interview that, you know, they think they can get all the uninstructed votes like when the next election turns. But I mean, that's a serious concern because young voters like UW-Madison campus, as an example, those are the voters that broke the margin in the 2020 election. The amount of people that voted uninstructed in Wisconsin more than doubles the margin that was between Biden and Trump in the 2020 election. We are an extremely contested state. So, I mean, whether Biden is going to have the support of young voters is a really important thing in the upcoming presidential election.
So you talked about the state being contested, and the other state you mentioned was Michigan. Are these movements a lot more popular in battleground states?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily more popular, but I think in battleground states, it's where there's like a lot of differing points of view. There's people that think this way in every single state, but it just seems so much more significant in Wisconsin because there's so many people that don't.
Is there anything you learned over the course of your reporting that really stuck out to you besides what we've covered so far?
I mean, I talked to a couple voters on student voters on campus for the article. And one person I talked to was like, yeah, I voted uninstructed. I'm in support of this. I've known about this for a while because, you know, she's passionate about Palestine and justice for Palestine. But there's a lot of other, I talked to another student who had no clue what it meant. She didn't like know that uninstructed was necessarily part of a movement against Biden and for Palestine. I think it's really interesting that there is not widespread knowledge about this. I think the thing that stuck out to me the most, though, is just the extremely high and significant difference between the way the rest of Wisconsin voted and campus voted, almost showing like a disconnect between generations. In Madison and in Milwaukee, which are both, you know, university towns, those are pretty much the only districts in Wisconsin that reach these high numbers. That's really just proving that there's like a disconnect between young people and Biden and also between generations in this state.
Well, thanks for coming on this week, Mary.
Well, thanks for having me.
In other campus news, the UW Board of Regents has approved a 3.75% tuition increase for in-state undergraduate students. At UW-Madison, in-state undergraduate tuition will rise from $11,216 to $11,604 for the 2024-25 academic year. UW System President Jay Rothman has said that the tuition increase is similar to the rate of inflation. In other news, the UW System will now offer 6 weeks of paid parental leave to all full-time employees who have been employed for at least 6 months. This decision comes following years of pressure and research into the subject by employees at UW-Madison. The issue was recently brought back into the spotlight by a letter issued by 40 department chairs at the university calling for paid leave. In more campus news, the Multicultural Student Center, or MSC, celebrated the 35th anniversary of its partnership with the Wisconsin Union as part of a new fundraising initiative targeting food insecurity. As a part of the fundraiser, 1,720 dollhouse-sized chairs splattered with paint representing four of the different cultural and student centers on campus can be purchased online or at either Union South or Memorial Union. This has been the Cardinal Call, created by UW-Madison student journalists. Check out more news and stories at dailycardinal.com.
Tonight, we're debuting our new food feature, Stuff Your Face, produced by new feature contributor Emily Tucker. With Earth Day right around the corner, Tucker took the opportunity to speak with local chef Laurel Burleson about a unique approach to fighting food waste. Burleson is the chef and owner of Ugly Apple Cafe, where they use ugly produce to fuel workers in the Dane County Courthouse and in downtown Madison. Okay, I am here with Laurel Burleson at the Ugly Apple Cafe, which is in the lower level of the Dane County Courthouse on Hamilton Street here in downtown Madison. Laurel, thanks so much for talking with me today after your busy day.
Thank you so much for coming down.
So, Laurel, I know you launched Ugly Apple as a food cart back in 2016. What has the journey been like from food cart to this brick and mortar space inside of the Dane County Courthouse?
It's been a long and winding journey. To operate a food cart, you have to also work in a licensed kitchen space. And so for me, that was mainly in Christine's kitchen, Christina May, who has Slide Potato Chips. I rented space from her. So I was there for about 5 years and was growing kind of post-pandemic and looking for a new space to kind of facilitate the different things that I did, which is kind of a lot of things. I mean, that's part of the journey too, I suppose, is doing the food cart in Wisconsin is seasonal. I tried my first year to run through the winter and that was hard and not super lucrative. So, you know, started making jam, started doing more catering, started making donuts, doing other kind of pastry things. So when it came time for me to find a space, it was trying to find a space that fit some of the different equipment that I had already for the different products I make. We found out this space was available in the courthouse and checked it out and it checked all the boxes and we've had a really great time here in the last year.
That's fantastic. Are most of your customers here in the building, people who work here, or do you get some community walkthrough as well?
We get some community walkthrough or people who are here for jury duty or to check out the law library. There's a lot of services offered here for the community, but most of my regulars work in the building.
That's great. So this segment will be airing in April, the month that we have every year to celebrate Earth Day. With that in mind, tell me about using seconds and overstock from local farmers or ugly produce. What does that look like day to day for you in the cafe?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways we try to use things. I dehydrate and freeze dry some foods. Also, we have a lot of flexibility in our menu between soup and a frittata, which is kind of like a baked egg that we have every day, and some other specials and items that can kind of use whatever produce we have around. And so if I hear from a farmer that they have an extra case of something that's blemished, we can go pick it up. Or last summer, I had a farmer reach out with a super overstock of picked strawberries that were going to go to waste unless I came to pick them up right away, and he could get me a great deal on them, and so we coordinated that. I'm working with a farmer right now who has some winter-grown rhubarb, like grown in the dark, and so I'm excited about that. It's really just kind of staying flexible and trying to use things wherever we can, and sometimes that's a fun puzzle, and sometimes it's a little bit more complicated, but we do our best.
Thank you for that work you're doing, and I'm a big composter in my house. Do you have any capability to do composting here in the cafe, or is that just a little bit outside of the capabilities here?
On a very small level, yes. It wasn't available to us until fairly recently. And then one of my employees right now is also a farmer. So he's working on his own business, mainly flowers and other vegetables. But we've been swapping out buckets, and he's been taking about 5 gallons every day or two of like coffee grounds, eggshells, I mean, and vegetable scraps to compost. Yeah. So once he came on and asked if we were doing compost, I was like, you can manage it for us. That would be great. To get in and out of the building would be a little bit tricky to do anything kind of on a larger scale.
Absolutely. That's what I was thinking. So you mentioned your fruit leather, which I believe are called apple straps. Of course, you and I both have small kids, and I'm curious, as an entrepreneur, as a mother of young kids, how do you find ways to work your kids into your business, integrate them into what you're doing, and just manage that day-to-day juggling act?
I mean, they love when I have snacks left at the end of the day. I feel like that's a great motivator. I mean, I think about them a lot, you know, in terms of the apple straps that you mentioned and some of the other treats that I do, like how can you sneak in party things and have it not just be cake all the time? Like one of the base muffins I have is, I call it an oatmeal muffin. And so even though, like, yes, there's sugar in it, I feel a little bit better about them having that. I have a carrot muffin and a veggie muffin, and they like them. You know, they don't necessarily know that they're eating vegetables when they get to have a yummy muffin. So, you know, just trying to think of different ways to appeal to them and then also like a larger audience. Like I have plenty of adult customers too who did not think they would like a veggie muffin even though they knew it was in it until they tried it. And I was like, oh yeah, this is pretty good. You know, trying to keep things more natural too and less of the super processed, I think also just makes me feel better about what I do for everybody.
I love it. You're clearly very creative. I also love that you serve breakfast all day. I am a big believer in an egg sandwich any time of the day, really curing what ails us. So what inspired you to do breakfast all day?
Well, when I opened the food cart, I really wanted to focus on breakfast food because I feel like that was something that was missing downtown, like a fast breakfast. And then as I started kind of getting my recipes and working on building the menu, I really just liked that food. And I was like, why isn't this available all day? Like, why are eggs relegated just to breakfast? So I just felt like it was something that was missing that I could really focus on and shine a light on.
I absolutely love it. Breakfast all day is the way to go. Do you have a favorite treat or food item here at the cafe?
So I do have a sweet tooth. I've been working on apple fritters a lot and then working towards, again, with the strawberries that we saved from last year, working on a strawberry fritter. And the apple fritters, the last time I made them, I think were the best they've been. I'm leaning towards those because they're top of mind. And then once we figure out the strawberry fritter, I think that'll be up there too.
Delicious. What is your favorite thing about working in food?
I love that everyone has to eat and that it's like a great equalizer of people. It's humbling. Like the people in this building, some of them are really important. They make major decisions that affect like everyone's lives who work in, maybe not everyone in Wisconsin, it's the county courthouse, but they make big decisions that affect people and they need to eat and they come to me to eat. So I can provide a service for those people and for the people who are here because they have to appear in court and jury duty. And so I love that food is a great equalizer of people. And I also love that you can make it as beautiful as you can, but at the end of the day, it's made to be eaten. It's made to be destroyed. And so I love that you can make something that's art and precious and perfect and then chew it up.
And what do you find is the most challenging thing about working in food?
Honestly, right now, the perceived value of food. If you can get something for a dollar, why would you pay $5 for it? Doesn't matter to everyone that it's handmade or from great ingredients or anything. So that's tricky. And then there's also just if someone can't afford $5 for a thing, like I don't want to say that that's what it is. You know, like just the perceived value of food and then the value, I guess, extrapolated from that we put on food service and people who work with food, and that I wish all of that was higher and more equitable.
Absolutely. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for providing delicious breakfast and treats for the Madison community and for caring about the planet in what you do, and really appreciate your entrepreneurial spirit here in Madison.
Thank you again for coming down. This is really fun.
Baby animal season is starting soon, and feature contributor Jackie Sandberg has all the details on this edition of Wildlife Weekly.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today we're going to talk about baby season, because yes, it's baby season coming up, and we are in the midst of our babies coming in everywhere. We have baby fox kits that have arrived. We have baby owls that have gone back and re-nested with the care of their parents. We've had baby squirrels admitted from being in an engine of a car, nesting above and underneath the hood. We've actually had two different batches of those already. So it is that time of year where we're seeing little itty bitty animals come through, and we wanted to do a quick PSA out to the public, talking about what to do if you find an orphan animal or an animal that you think might be orphaned, because not every situation is going to require intervention, and it's helpful to know what cases should be referred to a rehabilitator or which species we might care for and who you might have in your area and how to find those types of directions. So first I want to say that our wildlife center is primarily specialized with working with avian species, so birds, and also reptiles like turtles and amphibians.
We work with many mammal species as well, mostly those of conservation concern like bats and foxes and coyotes and other carnivore species. But we do work with a lot of different animals in general. So pretty much any native species to Wisconsin we are licensed to work with, except for raccoons, white-tailed deer, skunks. And we also don't rehabilitate invasive species like English house sparrows, European starlings, or mute swans. So there are, you know, probably about 130 to 150 different species that we admit here to Dane County Humane Society's Wildlife Center every year. It's an amazing number of animals, somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 animals a year, and they're either going to be sick, injured, or orphaned. So in the baby season, during the March to April period is when we see most of our baby owls, maybe eaglets, and some of our young mammals start to be born. So that is going to be the areas where you're going to maybe want to have more focus, keeping your eye out in your backyard. If you know that there are adult owls that have paired, and maybe they've made a nest. Squirrels, definitely making squirrel nests or drays up in the trees is a good one to look for. So looking at the base of the trees in case any animals fall down. Now, they really only need help if they are injured from the fall. So just as an example, a tiny squirrel that's in a paper nest made of leaves and sticks and, you know, hay and other soft material is pretty flimsy in strong windstorms. So maybe that little gray squirrel falls from, you know, 60 feet up and it hits the ground. That's a lot for a little squirrel friend to take. And they are with their parents for about 14 to 16 weeks in general from birth. So they do need a lot of parental care. So the sooner we can get the baby squirrel in for an evaluation to make sure, okay, you know, is it injured with bruising or fractures or wounds or anything like that? As long as it's deemed healthy, then our goal is to get mom to take that little baby squirrel back up to its nest. And there are ways to do that, and you can check on our website at www.giveshelter.org for instructions on how to reunite baby mammals back to the care of their parents. So if they are overall healthy, putting them at the base of the tree, keeping them warm, and allowing mom time to come down the tree to figure out, oh, a baby fell out of here, let's bring it back up. Or maybe take all of the babies to a second nest location. Rodents especially have more than one nest in a given season. So if you cut down a tree and there are accidentally baby squirrels in there, leaving a little nesting box with an open top, keeping the babies warm right on the stump of the tree when you're done, that can really be the best option so that mom will come back when the disturbance is all finished and hopefully take those babies to her second nest. For owls, they do have time periods where they might come out of their nest too early. They like to use squirrel nests, believe it or not, or old red-tail nests or other things, where the hatchlings will sometimes fall through the material, especially if the nest is really dilapidated. So you might find a great horned owl nestling, for example, on the ground at the hatchling stage where it's kind of bright white and fuzzy. And if you don't see any of those ear tufts, those really nice little kind of nubbins at the top of their head starting to form, might be right at the edge of too young to come out of their nest. So taking a photo of the situation, always going to be the best thing, or even a short video. And if you can send it to a wildlife rehabilitator to assess before you actually start to intervene or take that animal out of the environment, we can tell you if it needs to be there or not. So for a great horned owl, there is a point where they start fledging from the nest, and we call them branchers. So when they start to explore, they start using their feet, and they start practicing their wing flaps, and they find themselves in some precarious situations where they will fall down. But honestly, when they're at that age, they can actually use their amazing strength and those talons to ramp themselves up trees and get back up into branches. So they are actually meant to kind of be on the ground and exploring around at a certain time frame. So if you send a photo, we can kind of help you age what the owl is and then whether or not it's okay if it's on the ground. As long as the parents are still continuing to return and offer food to the baby or drop food near them, that kind of stuff, usually those are situations where it might be okay. However, a picture is worth a thousand words because an owl can still get injured from a fall even if it was a fledgling. We've seen broken toes and broken feet and broken legs, so it is something to keep in mind. So we want to figure out which animals are truly sick or injured or orphaned if the parents were not around. Those are the ones that should come in for wildlife rehabilitation. Now, we are about to see our baby ducks coming soon. That will be a whole nother story, but we'll save that for another radio segment day. And then another important one right now is that fox kits are coming out of their den. They're starting to get their, you know, eyes open, maybe 6 to 8 weeks old or so, and exploring. It's one of those where we want to monitor to see, do we know where the den site is? Sometimes, like our little one here that came in this week has sarcoptic mange, which is a little parasite that gets down into their skin layer and causes them to be very itchy and lose fur. So there are things that we might consider treating, especially if the adults have brought those mites into the den area, and maybe it's causing problems with the babies. Those are all situations where we may suggest intervening. So give us a call at the Wildlife Center if you find any of these babies here in this early spring season, and we can talk you through the process. Our number is 608-287-3235, and check out our website for more information about any species that you might find. And when in doubt, take a photo, take a quick video, and contact us. Check on our website for our phone number for our text line, or give us a call and leave a voicemail with your situation, and we will return that call between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. every day. So thanks for listening here on WORT today. We've been talking about our spring season, baby season coming up. And check out our social media pages. We'll be featuring some baby animals here in this next coming week. And hopefully get to see some fun photos and maybe bring in some donations for those little babies here in this next couple of weeks so that we can prepare for the season. It's going to get really busy here. Thanks for listening. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WRT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer tonight was Lila Grubb.
Special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg and Oliver Gerhars, and a special welcome to our new feature contributor, Emily Tucker.
And thanks to Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection and Dr. Anthony Nelizowitz of Yale's Climate Connections.
Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Hey Parks produced this newscast.
And Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Up next is Spanish Language News with Inuit Radio. Good night.